Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 231, and it is Monday, November 22nd, and we're somewhere in the respiratory chapter, so maybe we'll review just a little bit before finishing this chapter off. And so we have a nice picture over here on the right-hand slide of figure 22.3, which is a sagittal section of the airway, starting with the upper respiratory tract, right, which includes the nose, right, nasal cavity, and the pharynx. And a pharynx is what? A common passageway for both air that we're breathing and food that we're eating. And the pharynx is what? Just posterior to the nasal cavity, posterior to the oral cavity, and posterior to the larynx. And the larynx is the beginning of the lower respiratory tract. All right, so the pharynx is broken down into those three corresponding divisions. Posterior to the nasal cavity, this is the nasopharynx. Posterior to the oral cavity is the oropharynx. And then posterior to the larynx right here is the laryngopharynx. So those are the three parts of the pharynx. And when you get an infection of the pharynx right there, what do we call that in everyday language? A sore what? A sore throat, right? But in medical terminology, that would be what? A pharyngitis. That would be a pharyngitis. So here's the pharynx as opposed to the larynx, which contains these blue structures right here, which is cartilage, right? And you can get an inflammation or an infection of the larynx, and what would we call that? We wouldn't call that a pharyngitis. We'd call that a laryngitis. And what happens to you when you have laryngitis? How is that obvious? Because you lose your voice, or you sound really funny, you sound hoarse, because in the larynx right here are vocal folds. So when they become inflamed, they don't vibrate quite so much and you lose your voice. So it's easy to remember the difference between the pharynx and the larynx. Alright, so that when you're eating something and you swallow, food should go from the oral cavity down to the stomach and transit through the esophagus right here. All right, and so there is a special little part of the larynx that usually makes sure that that happens, and it's a little trapdoor. This trapdoor is called the epiglottis, and it flops down and covers up the opening to the larynx, which is what we call the glottis. All right, and in lab we were talking about this trapdoor. It has a tendency to get lazy on one day of the week as opposed to any other day. And what day of the week does this epiglottis have a tendency not to work? Friday. On Friday, and even a time during that day, like during happy hour, right? So it's usually associated with adult beverage and horsing around with a bunch of colleagues at work, right, at some kind of public establishment where you're eating popcorn or nachos or popcorn shrimp and drinking at the same time and telling jokes, and somebody tells a particularly good joke, right, just as you're about ready to swallow something, and then you inhale and swallow at the same time, and there goes that nacho into this airway right here. Okay, and hopefully you're around, if that ever happens to you, somebody that is what? CPR certified, because they know how to clear that airway for you, or at least in most circumstances know how to clear that airway for you. Doing what kind of maneuver for those of you that are CPR certified? Heimlich maneuver, right? And so then that just blows that material from this airway out your mouth, and you'll be really happy when that happens, because you can't live very long with an obstructed airway. It feels terrible when you're choking. Okay, so what are some other things? When we talked about the lymphatic system, we also talked about some tonsils, right? There are three sets of tonsils right in the back of your oral cavity, or in the oropharynx right here are the palatine tonsils. These are what you can see in the mirror. And then there are some pharyngeal tonsils that are up closer more in your nasal cavity, and some sublingual or lingual tonsils posterior to your tongue. And so you have these three sets that help fight infections or bacteria and viruses that are trying to get into your body from what, the oral cavity or nasal cavity. So what else do we have on this slide that's noteworthy? Well, all these blue structures right here are cartilage. And that's because Unlike the esophagus, which is normally closed, the airways have to be held open. Because in order to exhale, you need to pressurize your lungs or thoracic cavity, and that forces air out of your lungs. And when you pressurize your thoracic cavity, these airways would have a tendency to collapse, right? So if they collapse, then air can't move through them. So these passageways are held open all the time due to these cartilages. So we do have to be familiar with the cartilages of the larynx, and you're going to do that in lab this week, right? You got the epiglottis, you got thyroid cartilage, cricoid cartilage, the arytenoids. All right, so let's see if we can find where these guys are located at. Well, here you can see them. All right, so here's the epiglottis, here's the thyroid cartilage, and then inferior to the thyroid cartilage is the cricoid. The cricoid completely girdles the lower respiratory tract, which means what? It completely circles it. But not so for the thyroid cartilage. The thyroid cartilage is just anterior. That's the only place where you see it. All right, and then also associated just inferior to the larynx is the thyroid gland itself. All right, so here you can see that cricoid cartilage, thyroid cartilage, and the epiglottis right behind it. And then you can see the C-shaped tracheal cartilages as well. So on a lateral view, right, I can see the cricoid cartilage, thyroid cartilage, and back over here, these are where the arytenoid cartilages are, right, posterior larynx, and they are attached to the vocal cords, and there are muscles that are attached to the arytenoids causing them to move, which then place more or less tension on the vocal cords, which then changes the pitch of your voice when the tension of these vocal cords changes. Okay. The other thing I see on this airway, besides for the cartilaginous C-shaped rings in the trachea, is this muscle that's on the posterior side of the trachea. This is the trachealis muscle. All right, now who can tell me what structure is just posterior to this trachealis muscle? There's the esophagus is right here. That's right. So these tracheal cartilages are not completely round, right? They're just C-shaped because whenever a bolus of food is moving through the esophagus, there's a big bolus right here, and those cartilages then would impede the motion of that bolus of food down into the stomach. But that bolus of food can push the trachealis muscle, can indent that trachealis muscle as it makes its way to the stomach. Okay, so the larynx has those cartilages, the trachea has cartilages as well, and there's some other structures that have cartilage, okay, and that is a bronchus. All right, so the trachea is just a single airway. When it bifurcates into a primary bronchus, so here are the left and right main bronchus. And then a main bronchus is going to bifurcate into a secondary bronchus, and the secondary then will bifurcate into tertiary, going to smaller and smaller and smaller bronchi. But every bronchus, no matter how small it is, has cartilage associated with it holding that particular airway open. All right, so when you look at this slide right here, which lung looks bigger? Or do they look the same size?
No,
they don't. Which one's bigger? The right one is bigger because what takes up some of the space in the left side of the thoracic cavity? Yeah, the heart, right? So here you have the cardiac notch, and so the right lung certainly is a lot bigger. It has three lobes. The left lung only has two lobes as a result of that. Okay, so if we look at the primary main bronchus on the right side, we see that it is definitely bigger compared to the left side over here because the right lung is a lot bigger than the left lung. So that if you do unfortunately inhale something, it has a tendency to fall into the right lung more so than the left lung over here, and that might not really be a bad thing, right? If you get an obstruction of just one lung or the other, because then what are you left with? The other lung, at least to breathe with, right? You're not going to be competing athletically if that happens, but at least you can stay alive until they remove that debris from your lung. So that's particularly handy. Okay, these airways are lined with a special kind of epithelium. So here is the epithelium right here, and we can see some cartilage underneath, and we see a nice submucosa layer. But if we look at the epithelium, you should be familiar with this kind of epithelium. What does that look like to you? We zoom way in. Yeah, it's pseudostratified, ciliated, columnar epithelium. So depending on where you look, right, it looks like one cell from apical surface to basal surface and other areas. It maybe looks like it is stratified, but nonetheless, we can see the cilia on the apical surface. And here is a special cell right here. As a matter of fact, I have a hard time seeing the nucleus. I see a bunch of globules in there. Anybody remember what this kind of cell looks like? This kind of looks like a champagne glass. That's a goblet cell, right? And that goblet cell is secreting mucus, and we can even see some mucus lining the trachea right here. And that just helps trap dust particles, and that prevents dust from going down into our lungs and occluding some of the very fine small spaces in our lungs. And these cilia then are sweeping. They all sweep in the same direction. Which way do you think they're sweeping? They're sweeping up, right? So they're moving all that mucus up into your oral cavity, and it has all those dust particles in it. And then when it gets into your oral cavity, what do? Well, you just swallow it down, okay? Unless what? Unless you're a baseball player, and then you do what? Then you spit, okay? Okay, just making fun of baseball players. Not softball players, right? Baseball players. Okay, so that's something important about the lining of the trachea. So anything that has cartilage in it is what we call a conducting zone of an airway, because they're held open all the time. And then when we get to very small passageways, air passageways, in the lungs, we call them bronchioles. And bronchioles no longer have cartilage associated with them. They have smooth muscle that can constrict and dilate. So let's see if we can find... Come on, Mr. Cursor. If we can find some of the smaller structures in the lung. Okay. So here I have a passageway right here, and do you see any cartilage on this passageway right here? So if this is not labeled, what would you label this tube? Would this be a trachea, or a larynx, or a bronchus, or a bronchiole? A bronchiole, you could make a definitive characterization, because why? It has no cartilage on it, okay, but it does have some smooth muscle. All right, that can cause constriction of the airways. And so this is what we call a terminal bronchiole right here, and then it bifurcates into respiratory bronchioles. And on respiratory bronchioles, we see some of these little pouches right here, spherical shaped pouches, before we get to this group of those pouches. And those pouches are what we call alveoli. Right? As a matter of fact, in anatomy, anytime we have a nice microscopic structure that's kind of spherical in nature, we like to call that an alveolus. Right? So the lung is filled with alveoli, as a matter of fact, about 300 million of them. And these things are the site where gas exchange takes place between air that's in the alveoli and blood that is surrounding these alveoli right here within capillaries. Right. And the other thing that you might notice on these alveoli right here, they're crisscrossed with certain fibers. And I want to tell you something about these fibers right here. These are elastic fibers. So when you inhale, these alveoli expand, right? And then when you relax the diaphragm, guess what these elastic fibers do? Okay, since when you breathe in, they were expanded, when you relax the diaphragm, guess what the elastic fibers do? They contract the alveolus back down to its original shape. So, for inspiration, you use muscles to inhale, but in situations that you're in right now, which we call quiet breathing because you're not exercising, exhalation is just a passive process due to the natural elastic properties of the alveoli right here. Now, you could have a disease process that degrades these elastic fibers, and guess what you have trouble doing then? You can inhale just fine, but now you have trouble exhaling, getting air out of your lungs, right? Which is a problem for inspiration, because in order to inspire, guess what your lungs have to be? They have to be empty, right? If they're filled with air already, then you can't take another breath and breathe in. So those people are in a lot of misery as a result of that. So the natural elastic properties of these alveoli are very important. Okay, so we have respiratory bronchioles, maybe have some alveoli, so that's the first place in the bronchial tree where gas exchange can take place. Because surrounding the alveoli, okay, is this network of capillaries. And what's the function of a capillary?
Exchange.
That's right. So not only do you have these elastic fibers, but you also have these capillaries. Between alveoli, you have pores. So you have alveolar pores so that all of these alveoli have a tendency to expand and contract at the same time, or inflate and deflate at the same rate, supplying oxygen to each of these alveoli and capillaries. Okay. All right, so if we look microscopically at an alveolus, this is what it looks like. And there are two major kinds of cells in an alveolus. This right here is what we call a type 1 cell. It makes up the wall of the alveolus. All right, and can you so what do we call some kind of structure that lines a cavity? So here's a cavity, an alveolus is a cavity. What is this structure right here that's lining this cavity? That is a epithelium. Right, so how would we classify this epithelium right where I have the cursor right here? It's simple squamous. Yeah, it's a simple squamous epithelium, and remember that is the exact kind, right, that is very thin, and it allows for diffusion of gases. Right, and then right outside the alveolar wall we have a capillary. And what can you tell me about the wall of a capillary? Oh, maybe I can zoom in. All right, here it is. Here's a region. All right, so zoomed into this region right here, I see a capillary and the wall of the alveolus. So here is the nucleus of that type 1 epithelial cell. Notice how thin it is. In order for diffusion to work, diffusion only works under very short distances. All right, so air in the alveolus contains oxygen, which then will diffuse into the blood through this thin alveolar wall. And then here is the wall of the capillary. What kind of cell makes up the wall of the capillary? Again, it's an epithelium. What kind of epithelium does that look like? It's a simple squamous epithelium as well, right? Which is what? Specialized for exchange. All right, so gases can move very easily from blood into the air in the alveoli or vice versa, depending on the concentration gradient. Okay, so this is what we call the respiratory membrane. And what I call the respiratory membrane is just a little bit different than how it is labeled in your book, right? And it just kind of, where do we have it? Respiratory membrane, right? And so I want to go over the respiratory membrane a little bit. Here it is. Okay, respiratory membrane. All right, so along with the type 1 alveolar cell, there are some other cells inside the alveolus. Here are some white blood cells, right? These are monocytes that have left the blood, but they can move by diapedesis like an amoeba. They crawl around all over the place looking for bacteria and dust and viruses and fungi, and will phagocytize them, so they help maintain the health of the lungs. Right? And when a monocyte leaves the blood system, it becomes a macrophage. That just means what? A big eater. It just eats things up, gets rid of debris that's inside the alveolus. And then we have the type 2 cell here and here and here. These are type 2 alveolar cells. And these cells are very special because they secrete a substance that acts like a detergent or a soap. So if you were to get your hands wet, like underneath a faucet, and put some soap on your hands, how does that feel? Do your hands get more sticky with soap or more slippery? More slippery, right. So the product that these type 2 cells secrete is called surfactant. And it's soap, and it makes the walls of the alveolus very, very slippery so that it can inflate. Because water is actually a very sticky kind of substance. If there is water lining the alveolus right here, right, if one wall of an alveolus touched the other wall over here, it would get stuck together. And then what would happen? If they're stuck together, then you couldn't inhale, and the alveolus wouldn't inflate to accept any air, and then there would be no gas exchange. So this type 2 cell secretes surfactant, which allows the alveolus to expand. So that's all the parts of the respiratory membrane. All right, so don't forget, lining the alveolus is a thin layer of water which contains what kind of compound? Surfactant. Okay, so you got a layer of surfactant. So you might actually want to draw that in, a little layer of surfactant right here. And then you have the wall of the alveolus. And then a basement membrane or little interstitial space. And then the wall of the capillary. So that is the complete respiratory membrane. It's got those four parts to it. Surfactant, wall of the alveolus, right? This intermembrane space, the wall of the capillary, and that is the respiratory membrane. And in order for diffusion to take place, what is the thickness of that respiratory membrane? It's got to be thin, right? It's got to be thin to allow for exchange. Okay, so the structural and functional unit for gas exchange in the lungs is this alveolus right here. All right, how about membranes around the lungs? This is just a review from maybe chapter 1 or chapter 2, something like that. And I'm not even sure I have any pictures in here of this. Maybe right here we do. All right, let's just zoom in. If not, we'll just pretend. Okay, so what part of the anatomy are we looking at right here? What do I see? Okay, I see heart, and then, so the heart's in the mediastinum, right? And then I see the lungs. What cavity are the lungs in? Yeah, they're in the thoracic cavity, but there's another cavity inside the thoracic cavity. Just like the pericardial cavity is inside the thoracic cavity, or the pericardium, what's the space that the lungs are in? That is the pleural cavity, okay? And is this pleural cavity right here, just like the pericardial cavity, is it open to the outside world or not? It's not open to the outside world. Unlike the esophagus right here, which is open to the outside world, and these bronchi are open to the outside world, but this lining of the lung is not open to the outside world. So the esophagus and trachea and bronchi have a mucous membrane, but what kind of membrane surrounds the heart and the lungs? That's a serous membrane. And remember, how many divisions are there to a serous membrane? There are three. Okay? There is the part that's right on the surface of the visceral organ. Maybe I can really zoom in right here. So there is a part of the membrane right on the surface of the organ. That's what we call the visceral pleura, because it's the pleural membrane. And then here is the membrane on the wall of the thorax. So this is what we call the parietal pleura. And then here is a space between them that's filled with fluid. And that is the serous fluid, right? And that's the pleural fluid. Now this fluid in this space right here does not have any surfactant in it, right? It just has water. And water is very sticky, so the surface of the lung is like glued to the surface of the thoracic cavity. So when the thoracic cavity expands, guess what it does? It pulls on the lung and it expands the lung tissue. All right, so that's important for breathing. All right, so here we have that Here we have the heart. What membrane is right on the surface of the heart right here? That is the visceral pericardium. That goes by another name. Sometimes we call it the, oh, that's on the last test. You don't have to remember that anymore, but you should. All right, that's called what? Visceral pericardium or the epicardium. And then you have the pericardial space, right? And then you've got the parietal pericardium right here. Okay, so it's the same arrangement that we have. All right, so here we have blood leaving the heart, going to the lungs. And so what would this vessel be called right here? It's a pulmonary, sure, because it's associated with the lungs, but that's only half the story. What's the rest of the story? It's a pulmonary what? It is deoxygenated. So what is it, artery or vein? It's an artery. I tried to trick you. Okay, it's a pulmonary artery. It's an artery. Why? Not because it's carrying deoxygenated blood, because it's carrying blood away from the heart. Okay, and it just so happens the pulmonary circulation, arteries are low in oxygen, relatively low in oxygen. Exchange takes place in an alveolus within the capillary. Blood flows back to the heart, to the left atrium, and these then are the pulmonary veins that are more oxygenated than the arteries are. All right, so don't be fooled by that particular slide right here. Okay, so that's the cavities. Okay, so you got parietal pleura, visceral pleura, pleural cavity with pleural fluid, and it's mostly water, so it helps to attach the thoracic cage to the lungs. Okay, and of course you can get an inflammation in the pleural cavity right here, and I think we mentioned what that is. What would we call that? That's called pleurisy. Maybe somebody's had pleurisy in here. So when there's an inflammation of the pleural serous membrane, and that's very painful. Anytime you move the thoracic cavity, right, you get like stabbing pains in the chest if you have pleurisy. And the pains can be so bad that you probably don't even want to breathe. Okay? And so then you stop breathing. But how is that? How long can you not breathe for? Maybe about 20 seconds or 30 seconds, maybe a minute if you really put your mind to it. But how does that feel? Well, terrible. You're miserable if you can't breathe, right? So then you take a breath and then you have these pains like somebody's stabbing you in the chest with a knife. How does that feel? Well, that feels, yeah, awesome. Okay, that's pretty bad. So you get to pick, right? If you want to feel really terrible because you can't breathe, or feel real terrible because you have these stabbing pains in your chest. So you can imagine what a patient is like with pleurisy. What kind of mood are they in? They're in a really bad mood because they can't breathe, and when they do, it feels like somebody's stabbing them. So what do you do for somebody like that? Opiates, right? You just kind of erase their pain, and you'll be their friend for life, right? Not because they'll be dependent on opiates, but because now they can breathe and relax. And then you can go ahead and treat that primary cause for pleurisy, which probably is some kind of bacterial infection, okay, or maybe a viral infection. Okay, so for intractable pain like that, it's always going to be some kind of opiate. Okay, the mechanics of breathing. Inspiration is due to the enlargement of the thoracic cavity. Let me close this slide out. Oh, here's the cursor. I lost the cursor. Okay, mechanics of breathing. We change the size of our thoracic cavity due to the actions of a number of muscles. And there's actually two different ways that people breathe. These scientists and pulmonologists like to break breathing down into two main kinds. One is what we call quiet breathing, which is what you're doing right now. And then there's something called forced breathing when you're hyperventilating, like for instance during exercise. Two different kinds of things happen. All right, so for quiet breathing, the most important muscle for inspiration is the diaphragm. All right, so that's the diaphragm. And normally, the diaphragm has this dome-shaped curve to it when it's at rest. All right, and so when it contracts, it flattens out. All right, so normally the diaphragm, if you look at my hands, is dome-shaped. And when it contracts, what happens to myofilaments? They slide over each other, right? So like my fingers interdigitating. All right, what happens to the diaphragm? It gets shorter and the dome goes away, so now the thoracic cavity has changed shape. I'll let a marker. So the thoracic cavity at rest is kind of like this. There's the diaphragm. And then when the diaphragm contracts, it comes down to this location right here. So the volume of the thoracic cavity has increased by that much. Right, when the volume increases, the pressure decreases inside the lungs. Right, and fluid will move according to a pressure gradient. So now we have low pressure here, high pressure in the atmosphere, and guess what happens? Air gets sucked into your lungs as a result of that. Right, so that's one way that your lungs expand. The lungs also expand, okay, laterally as well. All right, so they move out laterally and also, which I can't draw on this board, anteriorly due to other kinds of muscles for other kinds of breathing, in which case that will enhance inspiration. All right, so some of those other muscles under forced breathing conditions, contraction of the pectoralis minor, the external intercostals, even the sternocleidomastoid will pull up on the ribs. Right, serratus anterior, all elevate the sternum and the ribs that will help inspiration. All right, so those are the two kinds of breathing for inspiration, quiet breathing and forced breathing. So right now, you're pretty much only using your diaphragm to breathe. But if you were to start exercising, then you would use some of these other muscles to help elevate the rib cage. Okay, expiration. When air flows out, right? For quiet breathing, it happens passively because, remember, there's a lot of elastic tissue in the muscle, especially the diaphragm. So when the diaphragm relaxes, guess what happens to it? It goes back to that dome-shaped condition. The volume of the thoracic cavity decreases. So now you have high pressure inside the lungs and low pressure in the atmosphere. So air then actually leaves the lungs. Okay, but there's something else too. There's a microscopic structure. Not only does the diaphragm have elastic tissue, there is another part of the lung that has elastic tissue that aids in expiration. And that is what? The alveoli have that elastic network around them, right? So expiration for quiet breathing is completely passive. You just relax and air flows out of your lungs. But now if you're breathing forcefully, that's going to require some other muscles to help get air out of your lungs. Then, contraction of the internal intercostals. Right? Contraction of internal intercostals will bring the rib cage down and will move the rib cage toward midline as well. And the rectus abdominis and all the other abdominal muscles like the internal oblique, external oblique, and transverse abdominis, right, will compress the contents of the abdominal cavity up into the thorax, and that will help expel air as well. Okay, so I do want you to know these different muscles for two different kinds of breathing and whether they're important for inspiration or expiration. So let's just review some muscles that we find between the ribs. What do we call muscles that exist between ribs? Intercostals, right? And how many layers of intercostals do you have? You thought you could forget all your muscles, but not really. You have two layers, right? You have internal and external intercostals. And so now you got to remember which ones are important for inspiration and which ones for expiration. And here, it doesn't really make sense. Okay, let's start with the superficial layer, which are the external intercostals. External are important for inspiration, and the internal intercostals are important for expiration. All right, so it kind of reverses. That didn't work out as an easy little thing to memorize. Okay, and the most important muscle for inspiration during quiet breathing is the diaphragm, right? And for expiration, then the diaphragm, when it relaxes, forces air out of your lungs. Okay, so what do we need for gas exchange? Okay, what do we need for gas exchange? We used to have a ruler. All right, we need a surface area. And, here's a nice ruler. Okay, how do you conceptualize a surface area? When I say surface area, I want you to think of one thing in everyday language. Like I have this piece of paper right here. What's the surface area of this piece of paper? Yeah, it would be the width times the height. Okay, and so it would be what, 8.5 by 11 inches. Multiply those two numbers together to get the surface area in what, square inches. So that's surface area. We could measure the surface area of this thing over here. What is the surface area of this thing right here? How would we measure the surface area of this doorway? We'd measure the width. Oh, look at the width. It's exactly 1 meter. Here's a meter stick. That's really handy. All right, so that's one, but we need to multiply one by what? The height. Okay, so what's the height of this doorway? So here is 1 meter. Okay, here is, exactly 2 meters. That's really handy. So what's the surface area of this doorway right here? It's what, 2 square meters. Okay, now how many people can get through this doorway at one time? Maybe 2-3 people, okay? Now instead of a pedestrian doorway like we have right here, think of the doorway on your garage that your car drives through, which is what, maybe 6 times as wide as this and probably a little bit taller. How many people can get through your garage door at one time? Is it just 2 or 3? No, it's like 20 or 30 people at one time, right? So as far as exchange going from the room to the hallway, right, as the doorway gets bigger, what happens to the rate of exchange? It goes up as well. They're directly related to each other, right? So as the doorway gets bigger, exchange is enhanced. All right, so what do you need in the lungs, a small doorway or a big doorway? You would like to have a big doorway so that oxygen can get inside your body and CO2 can leave. Okay, so that is why the alveolus has evolved. It's got a special shape that maximizes the surface area for exchange, but yet it does what? It fits into a small space. So if we were to take all those alveoli, which are what? Those little like berries inside your lungs, microscopic berries, and kind of peel them and lay them all flat on a table right next to each other, flatten them all out, that would be the surface area for exchange, which is really what in one word, English word? That's the, yeah, it's large, but in terms of function, what is it? I want you to think of that as a surface area, or surface area is really what, a doorway for exchange. Think of it as a doorway for exchange. And if we were to lay all those alveoli, about 300 million of them, there's millions and millions of them, what would that doorway be? It would be 70 square meters, which is what? Wow, geez, I didn't think of this before, but it's 70 of these things, okay? So here is, all right, so 1 meter is like this. Here's a meter, it would be 70 of these things. Or what, 35 of those doorways right there that we looked at. So what does that surface area actually look like? That's half of a tennis court. That's the doorway for exchange through that respiratory membrane. So that's pretty nifty, right? That all those, that the shape the alveolus has evolved, because I can't imagine why I would like to be as wide as a tennis court, okay, and half as tall. It'd be really hard to get through that door right over there, right? So your lung has folded up and is placed inside your thoracic cavity, but yet it still has that surface area for what process? Exchange. That's right. That's really important. Okay, so there's another part of the body that's important for exchange. Not in this chapter, but maybe in the next chapter. Can you think of another organ system where exchange is really important? Where you want, yeah, capillaries are always involved, but it's an organ system. Maybe kidneys, right? But what about your digestive tract? Your digestive tract, the lumen of your digestive tract is really outside your body, just a hollow tube coiling around inside your body, and you put food in there. But that food has to be absorbed. It needs a doorway as well. And so we're going to revisit this concept when we get to the digestive system. Okay, there has to be a big doorway for absorption of material through the digestive tract as well. Okay.
Is it small
intestine? Yeah, small intestine is the primary organ for absorption of nutrients. Large intestine is important for absorption of water and salt. Okay, so, and stomach not so much for absorption of anything. Okay, and I think most of you have done a dissection already. What does that small intestine look like? Is it a long straight tube? Or what does it have? It's got a lot of convolutions, right? Which means that you could take this big long tube and put it in a small space. That's one of the modifications of the digestive tract that aids in absorption by increasing the doorway for exchange. Okay, but we'll put that discussion off until we get to the digestive system. Okay, so let's talk about control of respiration. This actually is kind of fun to talk about. Oh, maybe this is a good figure right here that shows something about, oh yeah, this just shows, right, that before inspiration, the diaphragm is dome-shaped, the wall of the thorax, right, is kind of tucked in toward midline, but as the diaphragm decreases and the rib cages are elevated, look at the big increase in volume of the lungs that decreases the pressure so air flows in. When the diaphragm relaxes, that decreases the volume of the lungs, increasing the pressure so air flows out. So that's a pretty good diagram that shows that. Okay, control of respiration. The part of the brain that controls respiration, right, resides in the pons and the medulla. So here you see a nice enlarged area of the pons and the medulla. This is what we call the respiratory center. And there are a couple of important places that contain nerve cell bodies and dendrites. What do we call a location inside the central nervous system that only has nerve cell bodies and dendrites? And what color does it look like? Okay, it's called the nucleus, and it's gray colored because tracts are white. What do tracts have around them? They have myelin sheaths, right? And myelin is a lipid material, so it looks kind of white. All right, so this right here is the center that controls respiration. All right, so this is the ventral respiratory group right here. This acts as like the pacemaker in your heart. This will control the rate of breathing, okay? But there are some other important centers right here because the diaphragm, here's the diaphragm right here. What kind of muscle is the diaphragm? How many different kinds of muscles do you know about? You know two? You know, some people know three. That's good. What are those three kinds? Cardiac, skeletal, and smooth. So what kind of muscle is this diaphragm right here? Good for you to figure that out, okay? Think about it, because these different kinds of muscles are controlled much differently from each other. Now, it's a little confusing because you don't always have to think about inspiration, right? You could be asleep, but what are you still going to do? You're still going to breathe. So that leads you to think that the diaphragm is involuntary muscle, like cardiac or smooth muscle. But you know what? It really is skeletal muscle. Because you can control it. You can actually stop breathing. You can force yourself to stop breathing, We could all try this. I'll keep breathing, but you stop breathing. Okay? Because you could hold your breath until when? You're going to pass out. All of you could just pass out, but I'm going to stay breathing because I'd like to kind of see that happen. Okay? And as soon as you pass out, what will happen then? Then you're going to start breathing. So it's not going to be a big deal. So because you can stop yourself from breathing, it is skeletal muscle. I see some people chuckling and laughing because that's kind of a favorite trick that some children like to do, play on their parents to scare them, right? Is to hold their breath until they pass out, right? And parents can freak out unless they know that their kids are going to start breathing right away anyway. And a lot of you guys are laughing because I know you probably did that yourselves to your parents, didn't you? No, you're never. You're saying no. Okay. Okay, so the diaphragm is skeletal muscle. It's under voluntary control, but it can be controlled by the respiratory center in the pons and the medulla, so you don't have to think about it. As long as what is happening. As long as, tell me something about the condition of the pons and the medulla right here. As long as they're healthy. Okay, now people can get strokes, and they can have lesions in parts of the brain, and if it damages the respiratory center, guess what? Then they can't breathe automatically when they're asleep. Every breath that they take has to be instituted by a voluntary action. So you can imagine what that's like. What happens if somebody like that were to fall asleep? Well, they would stop breathing, right? They'd stop breathing and then wake up, right? Or maybe they wouldn't wake up and then they would just die. So somebody with that condition has to be placed on a ventilator when they sleep because they'd have to be awake for every breath that they take. And that's called Odin's curse. All right, so this is a really important area. So these different centers right here interact to make sure that you breathe properly, that you don't overinflate your lungs. It is possible to overinflate your lungs. So there are inhibitory centers that inhibit the ventral respiratory group so that you don't overinflate your lungs. All right, so what I really want you to know is where the respiratory center is located and that it has a number of different nuclei. All right, so go ahead, answer that one question. Where is the respiratory center located? Pons and medulla. And there's three important nuclei. Now, these nuclei send information via this efferent pathway to the diaphragm. What's the name of this nerve right here that goes to the diaphragm? I do want you to know that too. It's not labeled on this diagram. But it is on the slide, on the word slide. It's the phrenic nerve, right? Okay, and don't forget the origin of the phrenic nerve is what? C3, 4, and 5. Yeah, it keeps you alive. So that's really good. Okay, so since the respiratory center is in the brain, right, the pons and medulla, the pons and medulla can interact with other parts of the brain, like the higher centers, where your consciousness resides, right? This is where you appreciate your reality, like the visual centers here in the occipital lobe, right? Primary somatosensory cortexes in the parietal lobe right here. It's in that postcentral gyrus. So there are other things that can affect the respiratory rate, even when you're not thinking about it. So let me slide down over here. Okay, so if I were to walk around the room with a little pin, okay, and all of a sudden I jabbed you in your shoulder with this pin, guess what would happen to your respiratory rate? It would increase, starting with a forced inspiration like that. Okay, so touch and pain can change your respiratory rate as well as temperature. All right, suppose instead of a pin, I had an ice cube and I put it on the back of your neck. Guess what would happen to you? Exactly. Okay, you would go through a gasp reflex, right? You take a deep inspiration, and this actually results in the drowning of a lot of people because, especially around here, what's the ocean like around here? It's really cold. So if you're out on a boat someplace, and you just happen to fall off the boat and you hit that cold water, guess what your body does automatically, just reflexively? You go, which could be a really bad thing if what is happening? If your head is underwater, then you take this big lungful of water and chances are you're going to need help to get out of the ocean. If not, you're going to drown, okay? So other receptors can add impulses to the respiratory center. The cerebral cortex, you can voluntarily control respiration, like if you're a singer or a musical instrument player, or if you want to get back at your parents. Maybe try that over Thanksgiving. That would be pretty cool. Now that we're all in our teens and 20s and 30s and 40s. Okay. Emotional stimulus acting via the hypothalamus can change your respiratory rate. All right, but there's something else too. And that is, what's the fundamental reason as to why you are breathing? To get oxygen inside your body and carbon dioxide out. So there are receptors for oxygen and carbon dioxide in your body that will help regulate ventilation. So let's see where those things are. Okay, so here is a nice illustration that has the brain. So here's your pons and here's your medulla. So the respiratory center is up over here. And here is your heart. And here is one of the great vessels coming off the base of the heart. This one is a little posterior. This is the aorta. Okay, and then here's that first branch off the arch of the aorta. This is the brachiocephalic, and then it comes up over here, and then it bifurcates once again into the internal and external carotid. So this region right here is what we call the, I made a big deal of this in lecture, your book doesn't make a big deal, but it is a big deal, because this bifurcation, what do we call this bifurcation right here? It forms a little bulb. This is the carotid sinus. All right, so here's the carotid sinus. And in the arch of the aorta and carotid sinus, there are special receptors that help regulate respiratory rate. Okay, so we can break receptors down into, if we look at the slide on the left, central receptors and peripheral receptors. Where are central receptors going to be located? In the central nervous system, like your brain, for instance. Okay, so central receptors, since they're in your brain, they're very sensitive to small changes in CO2. Not so much for oxygen, which is kind of strange. You would think that you would have a lot of receptors for oxygen, but more importantly, it's important to have receptors for CO2. And CO2 is related to pH. As carbon dioxide increases, the pH or the acidity increases, which means the pH decreases a lot when that happens. And so the medulla and pons has chemoreceptors for CO2 and pH. So whenever CO2 increases a little bit or the pH decreases, right, that is a powerful stimulus for ventilation. Okay? And that makes sense because as CO2 is increasing in your body, right, you want to excrete it, but you also want to bring in oxygen as well. So that increases the ventilatory rate. Now, pH is a measure of acidity. Okay, it's a measure of acidity. Does anybody know what the chemical compound of acid is? Okay, it is this guy right here. We didn't talk really much about chemistry in this class, but it is just a plain old hydrogen ion. Like this, all right? As the concentration of this thing increases in a tissue, you become more acidic, all right? And as a matter of fact, as this thing goes up, as when I put little brackets around it like that, that means the concentration of hydrogen ion increases, then that number for pH actually goes down. So in a physiology class, you'll have to become really familiar with that relationship, which is a little screwy when you first think about it, because as the acidity goes up, what happens to pH? pH goes down. They're inversely related to each other. So it takes a little while for you to become used to that. Okay, so, but as the hydrogen ion increases, there's another compound that increases as well, and that is CO2. So, if you hold your breath and CO2 starts to increase, what happens to the pH of your body? Or what happens to the acidity of your body? The acidity goes up, which means your pH goes down. So, that's one way that your body helps regulate pH also is by regulating your ventilatory rate. And you have these receptors for hydrogen ion, or for CO2, as well as oxygen. Where are these located at? These are central receptors, okay, in the medulla and the pons, in the respiratory center. Okay, now you do have, besides central receptors, you do have peripheral receptors. And where are those located? Peripheral are in the arch of the aorta and the carotid sinus, and these are responsible for monitoring oxygen. But these are fairly insensitive. They hardly play a role in your breathing at all, okay, unless you're holding your breath and your body becomes very hypoxic or low on oxygen. All right, and then if you're really, really low on oxygen, right, so you see a lot of arrows right here, then these peripheral receptors can become a very, very powerful stimulus for ventilation or for breathing. And some people actually die because of that. All right, so as CO2, what is more sensitive in your body? Monitoring CO2 or oxygen? That's right. So even that will rise to the level of consciousness. As soon as CO2 starts to increase a little bit, guess what you're going to have a feeling of? Wanting to breathe, right, to get rid of that CO2. All right, so a lot of times, for instance, have you ever tried to swim underwater? Like you ever play a game and see how many laps you can swim underwater when you're a kid? So to be the best underwater swimmer, what do you do ahead of time? You can hyperventilate, okay, so you breathe very, very fast to the point maybe where you're a little lightheaded. And when you hyperventilate, guess what happens to the CO2 level in your body? You lose a lot of CO2 when you hyperventilate. So when you hyperventilate, you lose a lot of CO2. So what happens to your drive to breathe as a result of that? It's diminished. So you can hold your breath a lot longer if you hyperventilate ahead of time. Okay, so you can swim longer underneath the water. But when you're swimming and exercising, what molecule are you using up? You're using up oxygen pretty much at the same rate whether you hyperventilated or not, right? If you hyperventilate to get rid of CO2, you don't have an urgency to breathe, right? And then you hold your breath for a long time. You might hold your breath to the point where you actually pass out, okay? And this happens to people, right? And then they pass out underwater, and all of a sudden oxygen decreases a tremendous amount. What does the brain automatically do, even though you've passed out? It starts to make you breathe underwater. Okay, that's something that happens for people that like to free dive. There's people that put on like a scuba tank and go swimming around in the ocean under the water with a scuba tank. But then there are people that like to go fishing without any scuba gear. They just hyperventilate, right, and then dive down maybe 15, 30 feet and go fishing with a spear gun, right? But since they've hyperventilated, they don't have an urgency to breathe, but what are they using up when they're down there? Oxygen. And what does your brain need to stay conscious? Oxygen, okay, they don't have an urgency to breathe, but run out of oxygen, pass out, and then that's the end of the story for them, unless they're diving with a buddy or something, okay? So do you have any free divers in here that do that? Oh, I can tell. I can't say your name out loud because I'm recording it. Okay. So that's just a little, some physiology associated with these central and peripheral receptors. One last thing, too. Okay. Proprioceptors. What the heck are proprioceptors? Where do you have proprioceptors? In all muscles and joints, right? So proprioceptors can send information to the brain, like the respiratory center, that your muscles are working, all right? So as your muscles are working, what's a good idea? To be breathing quietly or forcefully? Move a lot of air in out of your lungs or just a little bit? Move a lot, right? Because those muscles are using up oxygen. So proprioceptors will increase ventilation, even just moving joints. Like right now, would you consider yourself exercising? No, because you're sitting down. But go ahead and move your elbows and move your knees, all right? Is that exercising? Not really, because you're sitting down. Okay, now notice What do you have an urgency to do? Just by exercising those proprioceptors. Yeah, you have an urgency to breathe because they send information to the respiratory center saying that you are exercising or about ready to exercise, and then this just helps prepare your body for that additional workload. So proprioceptors also send information to the respiratory center. Where's that respiratory center located? Yeah, the pons and medulla. Good. Okay, so that's it for this time, but I'm going to give you a quiz next time. Just a fun quiz on ventilation. So I want you to review your concepts about the alveolus. All right, look at that alveolus. Know the respiratory membrane, what kinds of proteins are around the alveolus, something about the doorway. What's that chemical that makes the alveolus very slippery and it allows it to expand? Sir something. That's like what you would call me when my boss is around. Sir. Sir what? Surfactant. Surfactant. Okay, so review that stuff for next time. It won't be worth any credit. It's just a quiz for fun. But you should review it anyway because you still have the final. Okay, that's it.